time for Yakety Science. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the vacuum chamber, the incubator, and the radial arm maze. We are the show that finds the sonata in your seismology, the concerto in your cosmology, the fugue in your psychology, the symphony in your syphilology. Do you know what syphilology is, Matt?
Is it related to syphilis?
It is related to syphilis.
Of course, that's awful.
It's the study of syphilis. I am Brian Cross. I do not have syphilis. I am an associate professor of biology at Tulsa Community College and your humble host. Maybe I don't need to state that I don't have syphilis.
Well, I'm Matt Smith, and I also don't have syphilis. Yes. Now that we're saying it, I feel like I need to.
First up, as always, the non-syphilitic leaky to my good all is Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Also, don't have syphilis.
Our guest, are you telling people not to have syphilis or that you don't have syphilis?
Oh, both. Let's go with both. You know what? Yakety Science is standing firmly on the anti-syphilis, wagon here.
Very good. Our guest on Yakety Science today is Professor Craig Davis, the Bolenbach Chair in Wildlife Management at Oklahoma State University. His research focuses on the ecology of wetlands and upland prairies and on the management of wildlife in those ecosystems. He is also one of my former professors, so he's long-suffering. We'll be hearing more from Craig later in the show. But for now, what's new, Matt? Anything going on?
I don't think so.
I tell you what we need to stop covering is these fast-moving stories. We keep talking about, like, the latest craziness of RFK Jr., and then it's superseded by other craziness before, you know, the episode comes out.
It's true. We lack the timelessness.
Right. We're not evergreen with our conversations here. That having been said, I have to mention that RFK Jr. came out with this idea about circumcision causing autism, and I think it's connected to the Tylenol causing autism. That whole thing, I can't count the number of times that RFK Jr. has made this mistake in different pronouncements, which he takes some piece of research, which often is a very poor bit of research, in which they have jumped clearly from a correlation to a causation without adjusting for all of the things that really competent researchers in public health know you have to adjust for. You have to adjust for contact with the medical community. There's going to be more diagnosis among people that visit the doctor more often, so you have to adjust for that before you conclude that some sort of correlation is meaningful. It's another example, and this is the timeless evergreen part of this, is get your science from scientists. Do not get your science from kooky secretaries of Health and Human Services, from fringe elements with no science training, and he doesn't have any science training, or from politicians. Talk to your physician. Do not talk to Donald Trump or RFK Jr. That's my big message.
It's fine advice. Okay. You know, I'm actually going to extend that beyond just science thing. I'm not going to listen to RFK Jr. or Donald Trump on any topic whatsoever.
That is evergreen advice as well, too. The other news, science news, very sad news, was the passing of Jane Goodall, who died at a very advanced age after a long and very fruitful and very impactful life. One of the impacts she had was on me, because when I was a young little boy...
Oh, you were one of the apes she studied.
I was one of the apes she studied, and she took me out of the jungle, and she put me into school, and now look where I am today.
You've come so far.
No, but I did look up to Jane Goodall, and I read all of her books, and I thought that was what I was going to do. It didn't work out quite that way. I'm still in science, but it didn't work out quite that way. But I thought, I'm going to be Jane Goodall. I'm going to go out into the wilds. I'm going to find a species. I'm going to study that species. That's what I'm going to do. Other kids were wanting to be airline pilots and things, but no, I wanted to be Jane Goodall.
You wanted to hang out with all of the weird primates.
I did.
And, well, you do have to go to faculty department meetings, so it's kind of the same.
That's true. Yeah. So anyway, she will be missed. This is a bad time to be losing people like Jane Goodall. The world feels very dark, and it feels a bit darker without Jane Goodall in it.
Ah, but we're helping put new Jane Goodalls into the world.
Hopefully.
That's what education's important for.
Do you have a lot of faith in your production of Jane Goodalls?
Yes. Absolutely.
Is that one of the learning outcomes on your syllabus?
Bruh, I am inspiring.
Production of Jane Goodall.
Jane Goodall, et cetera's.
This is why we aren't.
I'll also produce a Marie Curie. That's what I think.
This is why we aren't meeting our assessment goals. How many students did you teach this semester? 100. How many of them became Marie Curie? 0.
Failure.
Right. All right. Excellent. Anything else going on? We are actually recording video this time, so we'll have it to use in our promotional materials and clips and things, so we have to try to look presentable. I have to try to keep my chin up so that my bald spot doesn't show up in the video.
Oh, see, I can't hide mine. It's not really a spot in the back. It's just this forehead that just keeps on going.
Right. Now, I have an inland sea up here, and then I have a peninsula coming down the front right here.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I think I just have like two bays that are kind of just like coming together.
All right. How about some headlines?
Yes. Receding hairlines.
How about some receding hairlines? No, not receding. Headlines, not hairlines. Next up, we have the headlines. In this segment of the show, we trawl through, or perhaps troll through, the sciencey headlines that have struck our fancy since the last episode of Yakety Science. Since our last episode, we've had the announcement of the 2025 Nobel Prizes in Physics, Physiology or Medicine, and Chemistry. The Physics Prize relates to quantum mechanics and quantum computing. The prize was awarded to John Clark of the University of California, Berkeley, Michelle Devoray of Yale University, and John Martinez of UC Santa Barbara. I'm not sure I've got the pronunciation on those right.
Now, we've talked about quantum computing before, right?
That's right. Yeah, we actually talked about it in our very first episode. We have seen quantum computing develop in fits and starts with major breakthroughs in the last couple of years. We reported on our very first episode the release of Google's Willow chip, which took the number of qubits, that is quantum bits. We took that from 53 qubits up to 105 qubits with the Willow chip.
Okay, so is this award, the Nobel Prize, is it about quantum computing then?
Not exactly, or at least they didn't explicitly state that. The Nobel Committee, we can just read from what they said, for the discovery of macroscopic quantum mechanical tunneling and energy quantization in an electric circuit. So they demonstrated this behavior of electrons, quantum mechanical behavior of electrons in their circuit, and they observed this thing called quantum tunneling, which is allowing the electron to pass through barriers because of its sort of fuzziness, the quantum fuzziness associated with it.
It's so cute when you try to describe chemistry in physics terms.
I know it is, isn't it? I am all right on the edge of, do I even have a glimmer of an understanding of what is actually going on here as I'm explaining this? It does sound like something that the TARDIS would use to get around, doesn't it?
No. I think quantum tunneling is like, what if the movie, like Tremors, with the worms out in the desert? What if Tremors had really small worms? That would be quantum tunneling.
No, I think TARDIS makes more sense. Do you know what TARDIS stands for?
I don't care.
Yes, you do. We all know you're a diehard Whovian.
I am not.
Yes,
you
are. Yes, I see all those crocheted TARDISes in your office. It actually stands for time and relative dimension in space.
I'm sure that's so helpful to other people. But it's fascinating.
It does sound kind of like things slipping through the interstitial space of reality.
It's true. It doesn't just travel through space, but also through time.
Yes,
it travels through space-time.
No.
So quantum tunneling is actually when, we talk about wave particles. Wave particles can appear to exist or even like kind of teleport, even it feels like. To the other side of an otherwise impossible barrier.
Because they have a certain probability of being on both sides of that barrier.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I mean, wave particles are waveforms, so they have probability to be everywhere. Yeah. Well, sometimes there's a probability that you could be outside the room entirely.
Right.
And so some part of you is.
Right.
That's really, really bizarre, but that's the thing you get with quantum objects, and they manage to find it in a macroscopic circuit.
This is why you can't put quantum objects in prisons, right? You just can't. There's no way to punish them.
Yeah, they won't stay in the cell.
They will not stay in the cell.
Yeah, indeed. Though. Yeah, no one puts a quantum baby in the corner.
Does not stay in the corner. Very good. Very good, Matt. I like that. All right. Next up, we have the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. This prize was awarded to Shimon Sakaguchi of the University of Osaka, Mary Brunkow of the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle, and Fred Ramsdell of San Francisco for work on the immune system and the development of immune tolerance.
Oh, that's good. I like tolerance. Tolerance is usually thought of as a good thing.
Yes, tolerance can be good depending on the context. Tolerating Nazis is bad, and true, tolerating pathogens in our bodies would also be bad. But here we're talking about tolerance of our own tissues. And in that case, it is, in fact, a good thing. If you don't have that kind of self-tolerance in the immune system, do you know what you have?
Well, I think if you don't have self-tolerance, then you have self-loathing.
You have
That's bad.
You have self-loathing, and the fancy clinical way of saying self-loathing is autoimmune disease. So we have a long list of these diseases in which the immune system attacks the body's own tissues. So many of these are vexing diseases to treat. They're chronic, they're progressive. You have like MS, in which the immune system attacks the myelin sheaths around your nerve fibers. You have rheumatoid arthritis, when you get these flare-ups where the immune system is attacking the joints. And even type 1 diabetes, we believe, is an autoimmune disorder in which basically the immune system early on kills off the pancreatic islets that produce insulin, and so you don't produce insulin anymore. So generally, so the question to ask is, so why doesn't this happen to all of our tissues all the time? We've got this immune system, which is very powerful. Why isn't it attacking all of our tissues all the time? Well, that is because we have what's called central and peripheral tolerance. This is that we teach the immune system to recognize our own cells and to distinguish our own tissues from that of invaders. The central part of this was known about for much longer. That's what happens in the thymus, as the lymphocytes, the T cells are developing. There's sort of a filtering process that happens where the ones that react to our own tissues, they get suppressed. But there's also another kind of, that's the central tolerance. The work here that Sakaguchi did was on recognizing peripheral tolerance, which is another way that the T cells are trained. And this is through what are called Tregs or CD25 helper T cells. Sakaguchi's work kind of discovered those cells and recognized their importance. So that's why Sakaguchi is there.
Okay, but there were two other winners, so what's for them?
There are two other winners, and these are Brunkow and Ramsdell, and they worked on something called a scurfy mouse.
Scurvy mice? You mean they're like pirates? Like, arg, arg, curse you, scurvy mouse, you bilge-sucking, lily-livered son of a biscuit-eater.
Are you done?
Absolutely not. Avast, you scallywags!
Right. Not scurvy, Matt. Scurfy. I know that is a weird word. These are mice that had a particular mutation in a gene called FOXP3, and this caused a lot of symptoms that were very vexing for the mice, I'm sure. Very dry skin, lots of, you know, kind of flakiness and problems with the skin, and then lymph issues, spleen issues. It was later discovered that FOXP3 was essential to the development of...
Is this from T cells? Is this a connection?
This is the T cells. This is the connection. This is why they're all getting the Nobel Prize together, because they all worked on different aspects of it that then came together.
By their powers combined.
Yeah, because of the work they did, we have a much better understanding of how the immune system trains itself to respond to pathogens, but not to our own tissues. Up next, we have the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. So who won the chemistry prize? Matt, and please try not to bore us with another one of your chemistry snooze fest.
Snooze fest? How dare you besmirch the good name of chemistry? Avast! Toss this fool in the molecular cage.
Molecular cage? Surely that's too small to contain my greatness.
I mean, you're probably right. Your ego is immense.
No, I said greatness, not ego.
So molecular cages are the topic of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. These are called metal organic frameworks. And they're kind of like the studs of a house or the skeleton of a building. Mm-hmm. They provide little slots for otherwise gaseous molecules to soak into.
Hmm. Like a sponge.
Kind of like a sponge, if a sponge were really small and only for gases. And please don't squeeze it. They're actually very fragile.
Because they're flatulent, so that if you squeeze them, then
they're just going to shatter.
The gas will just shoot out.
No, it wouldn't do that. Look, their use is for enhancing gas storage. Mm-hmm. You could use them for that. Look, gases normally take up a lot of space, more than liquids or gases, because separate molecules instead of being a condensed state. Mm-hmm. And so they have that really annoying thing where they're always under pressure. They're pushing on their surroundings. So if you've ever seen gas storage tanks anywhere for storing gases like methane and propane, whatever, they have to be either really large to hold, a lot of gas under a safe amount of pressure, or else really strong in order to compress it down to higher and higher pressures that the gas can contain. So storing gases is heavy and very expensive.
Or you make it really, really cold.
Or you make it really, really cold. Yeah, in which case you can sometimes liquefy the gas. Yeah. But then now you're dealing with super cooled gas substances, and
that's hard.
That can be also kind of annoying. Yeah. So a kind of molecular sponge like this helps by soaking up the gases that are in the thing. So instead of being at a high pressure, they soak in and can get kind of condensed into a very small space. And so that frees up space for other gas. So you can actually fit, it increases the storage capacity for gases that we can't just liquefy. Mm-hmm. And so they take up the same space, but a lower overall pressure. Hey now.
I'm just kidding. This is fascinating.
This is actually useful. It's actually useful.
So who won the prize for this?
The Nobel Prize this year was awarded to Omar Yagi of Berkeley, to Susumu Kitagawa of Kyoto University, and to Richard Robson from the University of Melbourne for their work pioneering these frameworks, the metal organic frameworks, and showing that they can be custom sized to collect specific molecules. So that means that these sorts of metal organic frameworks can actually be used, these molecular sponges can be used to specifically tailored to grab and soak up certain sized molecules, which means we can also use them not just for gas storage, but for gas filtering. So yeah, they've actually even shown that we can use metal organic frameworks for decomposing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, capturing it, and it catalyzes it into other compounds that can be useful.
A potential solution to climate change.
A potential, maybe. We'll see how far it goes. But
all right. Thanks, Matt.
Very
pretty. That was surprisingly interesting. Up next, bird-eating bats.
Ooh, just in time for Halloween.
That is right. We're entering spooky season. We had a spooky action at a distance with quantum mechanics. Here we have the spookiness of bat science.
Vampire bat science?
Not vampire bats, unfortunately, but they are bloody giant bats. The biggest bats in Europe, these are the greater nocturnal bats, one of the few bats that are known to prey on passerine birds. This has been known about for a while, but now we have evidence that they are flying up to high altitudes and preying on migratory birds in flight.
That is some horror movie bat behavior right there. Goodness.
And so not only do the bats catch these birds while they're migrating at high altitude, you would think, well, you've got a bird, bring it back to the roost and have a snack back at home. No, on the wing, feeding on these passerine birds.
My goodness.
Right. So I think that the one that they had kind of the clearest evidence of was a Eurasian robin. So I grabbed that and it consumed it on the wing. So it's just... Can you imagine that? You're like, you're in your plane and you're looking out the window and you see a bat there and it's got like a bloody headless sparrow and it's just...
Is this happening at like airline heights?
This is below the cruising altitude of your, 747, but it's pretty far up there. Some of these events, right, there was one that was about, that they documented that it was, up around 1,300 meters. So, we're talking 4,000 feet around there. So,
okay. So when I'm cruising around in my Cessna.
Yeah. So definitely in your Cessna, or if you're in a big jet airliner as you're coming in for a landing, you might see out your window, you might see one of these.
Maybe just
bats.
Horrific.
So
that is pretty wild. About. Now, earlier you said passerine birds.
That's a perching bird. Warblers and finches and sparrows and all those things.
Okay.
Even your jays and your robins and so on. Those are all passerine kinds of birds as well too.
So like
passeriformes is the order.
What does that mean?
Perching birds.
Perching birds. Okay. Yeah. So once you come to your bird feeder.
Yeah.
So these bats are eating my bird feeder birds.
That's right. So yeah, your cardinals and your house finches and your chickadees. Those are all perching birds.
I suddenly don't like these bats.
I don't know. I would love bats if they would come to my bird feeders, and if I could see them hanging out, if I could observe them at my bird feeders,
you can build bat houses.
I might develop a stronger attachment to the bats than I have to the songbirds that come to my bird feeders. What's up next, Matt? Something spooky? I'm going to demand something spooky.
We do have more spooky stories, actually. So this one is about the Will-O-Wisp, the Will-O-The-Wisp.
Which I know are fairies.
Yes, that's right. And their link to the beginning of life on this planet, maybe.
Fairies were the first form of life on this planet. Yeah. They created the other life, right, with their magic fairy dust.
That must be it. This is actually, that's where I try to don't spoil the story for me, okay?
Go ahead.
Goodness, how dare you?
Sorry, I apologize. I just couldn't contain my excitement.
I guess, okay. So, but you have heard of the Will-O-The-Wisp, right? Ghost-like apparition often seen by travelers in a marsh, a bog, a fen.
Spooky shimmering lights.
Yeah, very cool things.
And they lead you off into the wilderness and you're never seen.
And you're never seen again because the fairies take you away. Absolutely, yeah. It's been long known, obviously, that Will-O-The-Wisps are not real. Mm-hmm. But the question is, we can explain what they were, but how did they occur? Why are these swamp gases igniting randomly in a swamp?
I see you've been captured by establishment science.
Oh, have I?
Yes.
I no longer believe in fairies.
You no longer believe in the science of fairies.
Right. Well, this is actually new research from Stanford University that reveals that micro droplets of water can exhibit charge separation and cause electrical discharges between oppositely charged droplets. It's very similar to how lightning is generated in a storm.
I was going to say, make that sound less boring.
Right, yes. Well, that's how it is.
It's lightning.
It's lightning.
Swamp lightning.
It's the same kind of idea behind lightning, but this is on a much, much smaller scale. They've shown that micro droplets, these mists, you know, sort of things, can actually exhibit micro lightning. So they've demonstrated this in the lab by studying water droplets. They were suspending them using acoustic levitation. Which is wild, like making something float by playing sound at it, basically, right? Acoustic levitation.
That's wild.
I think that's amazing. I would love to get a person-sized one of it, but I don't think they make those.
Just a really large tuba.
Right, yes. Play it really loud at me. That would be great. So they were able to show that, yes, micro lightning can produce sufficient energy to cause chemical reactions, combustion of swamp gas. Now, that's a good story. But no, the real story I'm interested in is that they repeated a version of the classic Miller-Urey experiment. Now, you know what that one is. Tell us about it.
I do know what that one is. We talk about that in every introductory biology class because it relates to the origin of life. Now, we haven't really worked out every little bit of how life originated, this abiogenesis, life from non-life. But we took a big step forward in understanding it back in 1953 when Stanley Miller, I think it's Stanley Miller and Harold Urey, they did this experiment where they set up a primordial atmosphere with a bunch of different chemicals, with methane, ammonia, water vapor. They put it in this kind of glass apparatus, and they passed lightning through it, and then they condensed it, and they looked at the organic soup that they got from that process. And they found that there were lots of things. You know, there were simple amino acids and carbohydrates and lipids and things that are important to life that just spontaneously formed when you put those gases together and you've got the lightning there. So they're doing this with micro lightning now.
It's not just lightning, but this could even happen with micro lightning, which is merely requires a mist of water. So these micro lightning things, you know, so small you can't really see them without a photo detector.
Mad scientists creating life in the swamp. This does have a kind of Dr. Frankenstein feel
it really
to it.
Does,
so you've,
doesn't
you've
it?
Succeeded, right?
That's
so,
right.
You've succeeded.
Ghosts, Frankenstein, vampire bats.
In the spookiness. Would you like to cap this with an evil laugh? There you go. It's alive. All right. Very good. Excellent. Up next, we need to deal with last episode's sound science puzzler. Here it is again, in case you've forgotten. All right, that's it. Matt, did you know what this one was? You found this one, so you know what this one
was. I found this one, so it'd be cheating for me to say anything.
Barry Friedman thought that it was something from a Stevie Nicks concert from the 70s, which was a good guess, but just a little bit off. This is the sound of lightning under the water.
Underwater, yes.
So this is what it sounds like when Lightning strikes the water, you're underneath. And
you have a microphone on
and
you.
And you have a microphone on you,
because you're a scientist measuring, you know, recording ocean sounds.
That's right. All right. Well, to all those who got this correct, nobody, congratulations. We've been told that we need to provide more hints for the Sound Science Puzzler. So we'll try to provide more hints, more guidance for the next one, which will be coming up later in the show.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's...
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. It'll be an element. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up the element essential to both quantum computation and breast augmentation. That's right, silicon, atomic number 14.
That's right, silicon. And geologists just love silicon because
it's
silica.
It's Claude's favorite.
Claude's, yeah, he said it was his favorite element, yeah. Silica is silicon dioxide. There's the silicate ion. This is part of all so many rocks and minerals. It's the base component of most rocks and minerals. 90% of the Earth's crust is silicate minerals. Mm-hmm. That makes it 28% silicon by mass, our Earth's crust is. So it's kind of a big deal. So think of most rocks. You know, think of those minerals, you know, garnets, beryl, tourmaline, mica, clay, quartz, sand, glass. Mm-hmm. All of this is going to have silicon in it. Mm-hmm. It's a big, big deal here. So yeah, it's a metalloid. So it's neither a conductor nor an insulator. It's a semiconductor is what it is. That's part of most of where silicon gets its use. You know, it is a semiconductor. So semiconductors are poor conductors of electricity, but their conductivity increases when they're heated.
So you cool them down, and then they don't conduct. You heat them up, and then they do conduct.
So you can control whether or not they conduct electricity or not, which is pretty sick when it comes to computing. So
sick is the only word.
It is the only word. Yeah, that means they get used as the transistor was the big, you know, electronic component, you know, that it could use in. It's used to switch or amplify signals. It replaced the vacuum tube. Silicon can also be used for photovoltaic cells because it's a semiconductor that will conduct electricity when given energy. Mm-hmm. So if that energy comes from the sun, then that solar energy, that the photo and photovoltaic can cause a movement of electrons when it interacts with the thing. So they can transition into conduction band by thermal excitation, but also by photo excitation.
Excellent.
I gotta say, there is one bit about silicon that really annoys me, and it's that really silly common misconception people have about silicon-based life in addition to carbon-based life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, as a loyal viewer of Star Trek, I know that there are silicon-based life forms.
Oh, right, in Star Trek, and it must be true.
They look like big, giant rock monsters, and they kind of ooze about.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you get where it came from. If you just have your basic chemistry in front of you, you know, we know that, elements in the same group have similar properties.
Yeah, and silicon is right below carbon.
Yes, it is. And so they're like, people are looking at it and be like, man, if there wasn't carbon-based life forms, maybe we should look for another element. What's right? Silicon. We should look for silicon-based life. The thing is that if you replaced, you know, people are saying, we just replace all the carbon atoms with silicon atoms. But the polarization of the silicon-hydrogen bond is in the opposite direction as the polarization of the carbon-hydrogen bond. So that means when the bonds break between carbon and hydrogen, carbon keeps the electrons. That's a big deal. That's how we get the H+ ion. Mm-hmm. If the bonds broke between silicon and hydrogen, silicon would keep the electrons. Mm-hmm. That would make the hydride ion. That is insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, hydrides exist, but they are, like, not stable because they're super reactive. Mm. And silicon doesn't form long chains like carbon chains, right? The carbon backbone, the backbone of organic and biochemistry. Silicon doesn't do that.
Doesn't form chains?
It does, but not silicon like carbons do. Mm-hmm. They do silicon, oxygen.
Now, I will say, since we're talking about life and we're talking about silicon, that we should note that there are lots and lots of life forms that form shells that manipulate silicon and that make silica shells. You have sponges that have siliceous spicules composed of silica. You have lots of little...
Salacious spicules? Is that what you said?
Salacious spicules. Say that five times really fast. And then you have things like radiolarians that have little cells that are contained in a little shell of silica. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So it does find uses. And of course, it's biologically inert. So it's going to find its use in biological systems. Yeah, very nice. That is what I have to say about silicon.
Can you tell me anything about breast implants?
Well, that's where the silicone is. So silicon, the element.
But silicone has silicone in it.
Is the polymer form of it. Okay. That's the silicon, oxygen, okay. oxygen. That's right. The silicone. And yeah. that makes it that kind of
and
rubbery.
And it's very squishy.
Yeah, it's squishy. It's rubbery. It's that sort of thing. So excellent. That's the polymer right. form of it.
So what's your rating, Matt?
My rating for silicon oxygen, it's such a unique element. It feels like this niche of like the semiconductors aren't – it's like the best semiconductor. So I have to give it 5 stars.
Okay. All right. Now, I haven't asked this question in a while, but what would happen if you put silica in a children's balloon?
In a children's balloon? I think it would just fall to the floor.
Just fall to the floor. And it would land on the kid's foot.
Yes.
Probably breaking the kid's foot.
It's true.
All right, so I haven't asked this question in a while, but what would happen if you put silicon in a kid's balloon?
It has been a while since you asked that.
I forgot about that question. That was going to be my standard for evaluating all the elements, and then I just forgot about it, honestly.
I mean, your standards are so low-loading. It's no wonder you left it on the floor. And that's where this balloon would be. It would just fall to the floor because silicon's in.
Think of all of the horrible things that have happened when rocks were thrown at people, and that's silicon, right?
Silicon
was thrown at people. I mean, think of all the young budding scientists, right, walking around with their pocket protectors and their glasses, with their noses in chemistry books and physics books, and being pelted with bits of silicon, right, making them miserable. So obviously,
I think you're being contrary, which is your lot.
All right, I'll give it 4 stars.
4 stars. All right, 4.5 stars for silicon.
Right.
There we have it.
These are becoming more and more meaningless as we go along.
No, don't worry. We're going to find a few elements that I think suck.
Okay.
Don't worry.
Excellent. The next one coming up is phosphorus?
It is phosphorous.
Okay. All right, excellent. So I look forward to that on episode 15. Thanks, Matt. Up next, we have our interview with a scientist. Our guest on Yakety Science today is Professor Craig Davis, the Bolenbach Chair in Wildlife Management at Oklahoma State University. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Well, I appreciate it, Brian. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Good to catch up.
Yeah,
when
absolutely.
I was taking your class many, many moons ago, you seemed to be focused on wetland ecology more and wildlife, but I was looking at some of your recent publications, and I was interested to see that you've been doing lots of work on upland species. Can you tell us about this work?
When you were in my class, I was much more focused on wetlands then, but I've always been doing work in terrestrial community. Bobwhite quail's numbers have been declining. For probably the last 60 years, we've seen significant declines of the population pretty much nationwide.
Okay.
And bobwhite their distribution is from southeastern part of the U.S. all the way to the western edge of Oklahoma.
Right.
And so, about 10, 15 years ago, Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, they were interested in putting together a large bobwhite project out in western Oklahoma to try to address some of the issues with bobwhite decline.
Okay.
And so that's initially how we got started doing this work, and it's kind of expanded.
And so what are those primary drivers of the decline in
bobwhites? So with a lot of species, like when I've done work with wetland bird communities, shorebirds and cranes, similarly, it's habitat loss.
So that habitat loss, is that associated with agriculture? Is it associated
historically,
with oil and gas development, wind development, solar development?
So those are things we'd be interested in looking at. And it doesn't mean that we have a negative impact. But from just the general habitat loss, yes, conversion. You hear bobwhites referred to as a grassland species, but they are more of a shrubland type, shrub-grass type species. But as we've seen loss of those habitats, conversion to agriculture, so into crop fields, the conversion of fields to Bermuda grass for grazing. Mm-hmm. And so just the general loss, and then you sort of have overarching with that is woody encroachment, and, mm-hmm. and which is, in this state, if you drive from Tulsa to Stillwater, yeah. what do you see along the roadside?
See eastern red cedars eastern red all cedar. Over the place.
Right? Yes, and so...
the plague of eastern red cedars covering the landscape.
Exactly, and so...
Matt doesn't understand that. No. He drives and he says, look, the pretty green trees.
Yes,
they look
yes.
like Christmas trees, right? So.
Yeah, I didn't see anything wrong with that.
Well, that's because you're not a Bob White.
Yeah, that's true. And so the loss of habitat through that as well, uh-huh. because once you get eastern red cedars encroaching into yeah. a prairie, it doesn't take many trees. Some estimates are for many grassland bird species. All it takes is getting about 5 to 10% coverage right. of eastern red cedar that you start seeing reduction in use of that habitat by right. those birds. And so it certainly has impacted Bob White as well. And yeah. and you look at fire suppression as also playing a role into right. that.
So you said the range of the Bob White extends from the southeast.
Yeah.
And are you talking about just in Oklahoma, southeast Oklahoma?
No, southeast of the U.S.
The southeast U.S. all the way to the western edge of Oklahoma. But there exactly. are subspecies also that are in the southwest.
The mass Bob White.
The mass Bob White. Is that yes. the only one that extends beyond Oklahoma?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have a mass Bob White. Is there also a volume Bob White, an energy Bob White?
Not
is there a time
not
Bob White?
Not a mass, but a masked. Masked.
Masked.
Like Batman. It's like a superhero. It's a
yes,
superhero
it's
Bob
a
White.
It's a superhero Bob yeah. White.
Suddenly
but unfortunately,
makes a lot
it's
more
declining.
Sense. It's numbers.
They have kind of a hood. The,
yes. Yeah, so. Yes. That is
to protect their identity when they're fighting crime.
That's
right?
true. So and they have Robin, sidekick Robin.
Right. That's oh, right. That's right. It's an interesting niche, the superhero.
Yes. That's a new one for me.
Quail. So. All right. So back to the serious question,
yes.
which is that. They cover a wide range, so they
yes.
must be able to tolerate a range of different habitat types, but they don't deal well with the eastern red cedar.
So they are very much an open shrubland type species, but you will find them also, if you get into the southeast, more of what are known as sort of these pine plantations they uh-huh. have, and they will manage for them. And so they like to have some open areas with some shrubby communities, but not
okay.
like a completely enclosed forest.
Do you have any questions, Matt, that you'd like to throw into the mix here?
I mean, I hear that you've been blasting heavy metal to the birds, and I want to know more about this.
Okay.
I know this is an abrupt change of topic.
It is
but,
a very
but
abrupt change.
I want to
yes.
know more because it sounds amazing.
Yes. So one of the things...
Is this Bon Jovi?
What genre are we talking about?
Well, the Black Crowes, I think.
The Black Crowes. There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So We just started projects that we're in the second year finishing up with one of our and I have to acknowledge one of my colleagues, Dr. Sam Follendorf at OSU, has involved a lot of this quail research mm-hmm. for myself. And we have a whole team of graduate students over the years, a research associate that works for us. So
yeah.
lots of people are involved with these projects. One project that we initiated a couple years ago was we were interested in how does anthropogenic noise influence animal behavior, how it may impact their health. We were interested in looking at that, and the study site where we're doing work is out in western Oklahoma at Pack Saddle Wildlife Management Area. And they have had a lot of oil and gas exploration and provide us a good opportunity to kind of look and say, well, how are Bob White quail? How do they respond to sound? And so we actually went and did some controlled experiments. Our student, Juliana McCauley, she would record pump jacks. And so what we wanted to do is you got structure and you got sound both being emitted,
right.
or one's being emitted and the other is just a barrier. So how do we separate that out to see, okay, well, is sound really the driver in terms of maybe impacting frequency of call, less frequency of calling, or maybe it impacts the birds are farther away from those areas because they cannot hear themselves calling or can't hear someone else calling out there. And so what we're able to find is actually the Bob Whites they're in terms of their, when we look at their proximity to pump jacks without sound, they were a lot closer
mm-hmm.
than when the sound was emitted. And so that indicates to us that it really the structure they weren't having much of a problem with.
Do you have any data? We have an interesting landscape here from a energy standpoint these days, right? Because we have all of this petroleum development, petroleum exploration, but then we're building wind turbines throughout the plains here, and we are putting in solar farms as well too.
Yes.
Those don't make much noise, so that's probably a good thing
they don't.
So do you have any data or any information about the effects of those things?
Well, I don't personally have it. We haven't done any, haven't looked at that research. But when you look at some of what the literature's showing, so wind turbines, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of like Greater Pritchard up in Kansas. Mm-hmm. You've got some studies that have kind of said, well, they may be restricting their use around the turbines. Mm-hmm. But some work by Brett Sandercock up in Kansas a few years ago that actually found that the prairie chickens were actually nesting close to the wind turbines.
Interesting.
And so the theory was that maybe it's because it actually keeps predators, avian predators, away.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you look at wind turbines, we know that birds will collide with them, and they can cause those types of issues. They certainly create berries in prairies, vertical structural barriers for birds. And so there's certainly some impacts out there from that. So are the birds able to tolerate?
Well, and the reason that we're wanting to do all of that, the reason we're wanting to shift to that is because when we burn the oil, that's contributing to climate change. And that is having effects on all of this wildlife as well, too. And I think a lot of your work has focused on how extremes of temperature or flooding are affecting these different species.
So one of the things that really interests us relative to quail is how are these birds responding to extreme temperatures? And we looked at it a couple different ways. One, looking at them during the breeding season. And we would just go and put out, one time we put out what were called little black bulbs. They're basically what they'll do is these bulbs will record temperatures, essentially what a nesting bobwhite quail or a prairie chicken would be experiencing. And so what we found is the birds definitely respond to those extreme temperatures, and they're seeking out or nesting in areas which are cooler. The birds, what's interesting is that when you look at the temperature close proximity of the nest, you can have temperatures out in the open on bare, lolly, it's sort of sandy, it's a lot of sandy landscape,
right,
up to 160, 170 degrees Fahrenheit. Just a few centimeters in some cases,
right,
in an area that is got some cover to it, you can see it, you know, down to 70 degrees, somewhere around that.
So you see these big differences.
And so the birds are, you know, selecting areas that are cooler. A lot of birds are. A lot of the quail are. And they're able to be more successful in nesting. And so one of the things we also found was that when the hen will bring the brood out, so after they've hatched, you get these young chicks, and in the morning, we track the birds using radio telemetry.
Mm-hmm.
One of my former PhD students did this. We track the birds early in the morning and during really hot days. And so they'd be walking around, and we presume they're feeding, but he's able to track them.
Right.
And you get to about midday, 1, 2 o'clock, where it is nasty hot out. You know, it's easily 100 degrees, upper 90s into the hundreds. The birds immediately go seek out, and in this case, out in Western, you'll have what are known as motts. They are post oak, shinery oak hybrids. So basically, a little oasis out in that region where the birds will seek that out and basically just hang out there until the temperature's cool later in the day. That was interesting to see how the birds were actually responding to hot temperatures, and the fact that habitat is critical. It basically acts as a thermal refugia for the for the birds during these extreme temperatures. It may not be very important for the birds any other time of the year, possibly, but during those extreme temperatures, it's critically important to the birds.
So when you think about managing for those species and managing with an eye towards climate change and these more extreme temperatures, looking at how many of those refugia you have is an important factor, and how can you foster more of them for those birds?
That is exactly right.
So we can shift gears here a little bit and maybe talk about the effects on wetlands. Obviously, if it's you have long heat spells, then you're going to get wetlands dry up that wouldn't normally dry up, or they're going to have shorter periods of inundation. But then you also might have more intense periods of rains that would change the hydrology
as well. Tell us about
well
the wet and wild times you've had in the with the wetland wildlife.
Yes. He wanted that to be the first question.
Well,
he
was you know, as they say in Vegas.
I held back.
Know, what stays in the, what happens in the wetland stays in the wetland. So you know, one of the things we've been involved with over the last few years is really trying to understand how future climate will impact really the availability of wetlands on the landscape, the amount of water that's going to be on the landscape. And so we've been, myself and Dr. Scott Loss at OSU, and then along with one of our former postdocs, Dave Londy, and then some students. One of the big things we were looking at with some of that work was actually modeling what the future holds for wetlands in the Great Plains. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not surprisingly, we find there's going to be less wetlands available. That creates issues for a lot of migratory water birds because these wetlands, I always like to think of these wetlands as being little convenience stores that are, that birds are going north or south and they stop by to load up, get your replenished, depleted nutrient and energy reserves and continue migrating to get up to the breeding grounds up in the Arctic. And so as you remove these stepping stones, that then can have an impact on survival and reproduction. You know, how the species are responding to it, you know, that's the thing we've been really trying to focus on mostly with shorebirds. And those birds are really tied to these wetlands.
Yeah, I know that, I mean, we've been following for a while. I don't know about the last 7 months, but we've been following for a while a policy of no net loss of wetlands. And we've done a lot of, like, try to create wetlands to make up for wetlands we've lost. And I know that often, though, those wetlands we create are not functionally the same as the ones that that we lose.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's just, now, that said, you know, at the point, we've lost 50% of our wetlands in North America. So any kind of water that we get on the landscape is going to be good, even if it's poor quality, is what I would say. In
fact, even if it's the little retention ponds with cattails around the edge of it.
Or sewage lagoons.
Right, sewage lagoons.
so, you know, that's the...
It's very attractive to the sewage plover.
It's
one of the most objectionable of all birds, the sewage plover.
Yes.
I just made that up, Matt. There's no sewage plover.
Yes. Right, so. Don't look it up.
Don't look it up.
I know not to believe you anyway.
Yes.
So there have been lots and lots of changes and proposed changes at the federal level. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what the effect has been on you personally, your research program.
Yeah, well, it certainly has been. Anybody that's involved with research, any scientist, I think there's a lot of uncertainty. And
to say the least, yes.
To say the least. I mean, on a personal level, I know of some of our former students at Oklahoma State University that laid off, that worked for NRCS, worked for Fish and Wildlife Service. They had just started their careers and were, well, RIFT or however you want to. Right. And so, on a personal level, I've seen that. I've got friends that are still under the gun, so to speak, of maybe losing their jobs. And so there's that personal level from that standpoint. From the research perspective, seeing that funding being cut and the research being held up, you know, that has real consequences. And so personally, in terms of what we've seen with some of our projects, we've got some climate science research and I just actually heard today that the South Central Climate Adaptation Center in Norman, and then there's two other climate science centers are going to be closed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've worked with those people. We've had funding that came through, USGS funding, and we think our funding is going to be fine for this next 2 years. We've got a postdoc and we haven't heard if it'll be cut, but I know of colleagues of mine that have had projects that have been cut. And so, this country, just sort of a broad sense, this country has been the envy of the world in terms of what our dedication to science, our funding, our willingness to fund research, our willingness to support graduate students. It's easy to have sort of draconian cuts and just, you know, wipe the slate clean. It's very difficult to rebuild in the same, you know, you're not going to rebuild it in the amount of time that you cut it. And so that's that to me is the scary thing for a lot of scientists. And, you know, a lot of these programs that are being cut, we may never see them come back again, or at least not in my lifetime, maybe. Yeah. And you know, as a scientist and a faculty member, where I have had probably 30 to 40 graduate students that I have actually mentored and advised, you know, it's awful hard to actually be positive with them in terms of saying, you know, yeah, it's going to be good and it's going to be fine and you should stick it out and there's going to be jobs out there and you're going to be able to do what you want to do. I don't know if you can really say that right now.
Right. Yeah. And it's hard not to just, you know, say, okay, I'm not telling you not to be a scientist, but I'm telling you that the world has changed in a very significant way that may affect you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it just, it's changed in such a rapid
right. No, it's head spinning. We're all kind of traumatized by it,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
Well, Professor Craig Davis, it's been a pleasure to have you on. It's been a pleasure to catch up with you.
Yeah, I've really appreciated it. It's great seeing you again, Brian, after I don't know how many
20 years,
something like that. Yeah. So that's been great. And thanks for having me on.
All right. Great. Excellent.
Ironikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up next, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. So that's it. Now, this is a bird that is mimicking these sounds. And so the question is, what bird has this prodigious capacity for mimicry? There are lots of birds that do mimicry, but this is one of the ones that has just sort of reached the apex of sound mimicry.
I think I heard R2-D2 in there somewhere.
Probably.
That's very impressive. So,
which is a sign that R2-D2 has been wandering through the forest.
Possibly
this bird.
So.
All right. If you think you know the answer, send it to yakityscience@gmail.com. Be sure to include your name, your phone number, your email address, your social security number, your mother's maiden name, and your date of birth. All of those are very much appreciated. We'll have the answer to this sound science puzzler on the next episode of Yakety Science. Well, that's it for this episode of Yakety Science. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a scientist of note. This episode's quote comes from, fittingly enough, Jane Goodall. She said, "It is these undeniable qualities of human love and compassion and self-sacrifice that give me hope for the future. We are indeed often cruel and evil. Nobody can deny this. We gang up on each other. We torture each other with words as well as deeds. We fight, we kill, but we are also capable of the most noble, generous, and heroic behavior." With those wise words, we leave you, dear listener, until next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
See you then.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakityscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
I don't know, ever since you said your upland birds, I've been seeing an uptown girl in my head. I'm like, upland birds, he's been studying the dry prairie world. I can't get past, and I don't have the next line.
That's
so.
Just going over and over again in
that's
his
all
mind.
I'm doing. That's why I'm not paying attention to anything you're saying. I don't know, yeah. I think you'd want to see a masked Bob White.